Thank you, everyone, for joining us. This is Dr. Will Tuttle, and it is July 20th, 2017. This is the third Thursday of July, and this is the third Thursday World Peace Diet call, the World Peace Diet Circle teleconference call. This is an opportunity for us to get together remotely, so to speak, and put together through this teleconference hookup that we have through freeconferencing.com, and to discuss the main ideas in the World Peace Diet, to discuss any questions or issues that may be on your mind, or any, or share any successes, or celebrate the progress that we're making, or bemoan the slowness of the progress that we're making, liberating animals in ourselves. But it's really up to us. This is your time. I'm here to respond to your questions and concerns and ideas, whatever you'd like. So press, oh gosh, I always forget, star six. Press star six, I believe it is, if you'd like to be unmuted. So that's me just see on the screen here that I have, if you'd like to be unmuted, and then we can everyone can hear what you have to say. All right, so usually when we begin our time together, we take just a minute, a few minutes maybe, and have a short meditation time, kind of like a guided or semi-guided, I guess, just chance to tune in to the fact that we are very fortunate to be able to connect in this way. So let's take a moment, wherever you happen to be, if you're able to close your eyes, that might be nice to go within. Otherwise, of course, enjoy whatever you're doing, looking out and being, and let's give thanks for this beautiful day, this precious opportunity that we have on this Thursday evening to connect in spirit and in consciousness and in our awareness, in our minds and hearts, to share ideas and to open to the higher wisdom that comes forth when we listen to our inner intuitive understanding of things and share ideas with an attitude of respect and yearning to deepen our understanding and to be part of the solution to the problems that we face here on planet Earth at this time. We give thanks for all of those who have gone before us, who have in many ways helped to lay the groundwork for the progress that we're making, and all the people who are on the planet right now who are working diligently and persistently to raise awareness about the consequences of abusing animals for food and other products, and who are going vegan and spreading the message of the World Peace Diet in their own ways, and those who are to come, all the pre-vegans who we don't even know who they are, that are going to be picking up the banner and lifting the weight that we are all carrying to help make it a little easier for all of us to bring this message to an ever-increasing number of people. We give thanks for all the progress that we see being made around us on so many different levels to see that we are part of a movement that is bringing us to possibility that we may be able as humanity to actually live our lives on this earth the way we're intended to, rather than being a scourge of devastation and misery and violence to other animals and ecosystems and each other, that we can question the official stories in our culture and begin to trust our own hearts and inner wisdom and transform our lives in alignment with our values, so that we're living in alignment with our values, and then share these ideas with other people and find creative ways to do that and to support each other in doing that. So that's the message. I want to thank all of you for joining us. That's the opening, giving thanks for this opportunity and celebrating really this opportunity that we have, not only right now, this moment, and for the next hour or so, but this lifetime that we have, that every day does give us opportunities. We never know what's going to happen and what door may open, and to realize that every day there are doors that can open for us to learn and grow and live and share and deepen our understanding, and that there is an awful lot of momentum building in many ways around this animal liberation movement and the movement for returning home to our true nature as beings of kindness and respect and caring for ourselves and our loved ones and for all beings. All right, so bless you all. I am delighted that you're able to join us, and Madeline and I both send you our love and appreciation for all of your efforts. It's great that we're able to get together this way. A lot of the people who are on the call, it does not say your name. It just says wireless caller, so it's a lot of wireless callers on, and that's great. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about a few things that are of interest. Every month there's always things to talk about, it seems, what's been happening over the last month, and also what I see, what I've noticed is sort of unfolding in the movement, and then bearing in mind, like I said earlier, some of you have come on since I said it, that this is really your time. So if you get tired of listening to me babble on here, just press *6 and you can babble it on yourself. Say something if you'd like, or ask a question, or make a comment, or ask the group for clarity about something, or just share an idea or a thought. It's really totally fine if you'd like to do that, because this is the whole point of the World Peace Diet Circle. So, but what I would like to talk about, I guess, a little bit is just what's been happening since the last time we were together, which was the third Thursday in June, and on the 15th. And so right after that, we went, it's just kind of interesting things. We went to, on the 17th, on Saturday, to a new sanctuary, which has been started by a woman, some of you know her, Miyoko Shinner. Miyoko is obviously Japanese, and she's pretty well known. She's been in the vegan movement for years as a chef and entrepreneur. I remember back in the old days, probably 20 years ago, she created the UnTurkey, which was a vegan turkey, which was delicious. It was brilliant. It was made out of soy and wheat, I think protein, and also that stuff called yuba. Yuba is a byproduct of making tofu. It's like a skin that comes from the soy protein. When you let tofu sit, it can create a skin on the top, and usually it's, I guess, thrown away, but you can save it. And so she used the yuba to make the skin of the turkey, I remember. And we had a nice connection way back in the old days, and then she got out of the movement quite for a while and got into real estate and this and that, but she's come back in the last few years, and she, as you probably know, she's a wonderful person. She's making these aged cheeses, which are a huge hit. They're vegan cheeses, people are saying, are like the greatest. There's a lot of great vegan cheeses now, actually. There's so many people making kind of cottage industry vegan cheeses, aged cheeses with amazing ingredients. Very often they're based on cashews or coconut or tapioca or other things. But she has started up in Marin County, the Miyoko's cheese factory, Miyoko's Creamery, I guess it's called, and she makes butter and cheese and all these things. And then she's also now, apparently, I don't know exactly all the details, but she's just opened, I guess, a very large, she's bought a large factory in Petaluma, which is supposedly going to be running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just kicking out and making vegan cheese. I mean, isn't that a great thing? Love that. So she's also in Nicasio, which is kind of out in West Marin. She has a house, and now she's started a sanctuary. She has a couple of cows, some pigs, some chickens, turkeys, sheep, goats there. It's not a big sanctuary. It's pretty small, but she decided to have her first fundraiser so she can make some you know, raise some money so she can build a barn. And so I was able to be there and give a talk. She asked me to do that. And also in the house, they have a grand piano, which is kind of cool. It's very rare that I can go to a farm sanctuary and there's a grand piano at the farm sanctuary, but there is in her case. And so I was able to play some pieces for everyone. There was a good crowd there. I think there was probably 150 people that come from all over. It was great to see people that come from not only Marin County and San Francisco, but Berkeley and Oakland and from down, a lot of people from San Jose and Palo Alto. Some people from as far away as Chico. Lanny Muehlrath, if you know Lanny Muehlrath is a pretty well-known vegan author, and she was there, and from Chico, but there were, you know, we were from all the way from Lake County, and it was just a beautiful time. There's a woman named Jasmine Singer who's has a podcast called Our Hen House, which is one of the, I think, one of the better, more well-known vegan podcasts been going on for quite a few years, with her partner, who's a woman who's a vegan lawyer in New York City. And Jasmine has left New York City. She now lives in Santa Cruz and is working on the staff. She's actually one of the main editors for Veg News magazine. She's quite a good writer, and I actually asked her to write an essay for the book Circles of Compassion, which came out a couple of years ago, on intersectionality or the interconnectedness of social justice issues. So she's a longtime vegan and also very active in the heterosexism kind of field as well. And so she gave a talk too. So she gave a talk and I gave a talk at the sanctuary opening. So that was last Saturday, and I have to say it was just amazing, you know, because Miyoko is also terrific at creating delicious food, and the food at this sanctuary opening or fundraiser was amazing. It was really so abundant and so delicious, and very comfort food. It was comfort food, I have to say. It was, you know, a lot of cheese and but other dishes. A lot of there were vegetable dishes, and there were desserts from catered and made by Millennium Vegan Restaurant, which you all probably know Millennium. The chef is Eric Tucker, who's written a book, and he's one of the most famous vegan chefs in the movement. And Millennium has now closed in San Francisco and opened in Oakland, and it's doing very well in Oakland, apparently. So he sent over a whole slew of vegan cake and cookies and things like that. So there was that, and anyway, there's a lot of food and the animals and talks, and it was really a beautiful, beautiful event. And then a few days later, we left and went on a lecture tour up to the Northwest, up as far as Portland. And the first stop was Weaverville. And I don't know if probably you've never heard of Weaverville, but that was actually a wonderful surprise to me, because we didn't really expect a lot in Weaverville, which is a small town in the Trinity Alps. But it's a lot of old hippies living there, and a lot of people who are very concerned about the environment and suffering of animals. And, of course, in those kind of places, typically in Northern California, there's also a lot of people who are very interested in free-range meat, organic meat, organic dairy, grass-fed meat, and so forth. That's a good way to be environmentally savvy and healthy and everything else. But there's a few vegans in the community, and they were able to really do a good job getting the word out. And there's one, you know, just, like I say, it's a small town, relatively small town, but there's this one venue in Weaverville, which is the Arts Center, the Weaverville Arts Center for the Performing Arts, CPA. And the Center for the Performing Arts is really very impressive, and they have a stage that holds about 250 people in a really beautiful auditorium with grand piano on stage. So I gave my lecture right there. There was a good crowd, and good food was provided, and we just really, it just started off on a big bang for that event. It was fantastic, actually. They really had a lot of people, and it was very classy, and I could play the piano along with the lecture, and Madeline had her paintings up, and they were very kind and loving people. And then afterwards, we spent the night I know Lily's on the call here, Lily and Lily Macy, who has a Wealthyside Sunday. She lives, you know, pretty far out in the boondocks and gets all of her electricity from solar panels and so forth. And this, we stayed in a woman's house who had pretty much done that herself single-handedly. She'd had people help her. She had, you know, contractors, but she lived out, way out outside of town. And Weaverville is sort of up by Mount Shasta, but in the mountains. It's called the Trinity Alps. And there was snow all over the place. You know, this is pretty remarkable for in late June that there was snow peaks. I mean, not all over the place where we were, but you could see snow all around in the hills, in the mountains. The view was quite a bit of snow. So, she was quite a great person to get to know a little bit, and she was inspiring, you know, to see someone building a place like that on the land and being vegan and having a little garden and creating really a beautiful space for herself. Her husband had died, and so she decided she would get depressed and just decided to go out into nature and create a space, and she did it. And it's beautiful, and she seems to be thriving there. And so that was neat to see, and I think it's something we can all learn from. I feel like I can learn from it. Anyway, the ways that people connect with nature. One of the big things, I think, really, for our society in general, to be more healthy, is to connect more with nature. We're so disconnected, and in Weaverville, it's really nestled kind of in the mountains there. So a lot of people live out close to nature, and I think that doesn't necessarily mean that people will be more kind and loving, but I think it does give the opportunity, at least, for connecting more intimately with animals and with the rhythms of nature and with our own inner wisdom. So that was that, and then we went on up to Ashland for a couple of days, gave lectures on Thursday and Friday night there in the library, and also in someone's house was a vegan potluck. A woman who was a yoga teacher there, and we love Ashland. It's always been one of our favorite places to go, and they have beautiful, gosh, they had this stream coming down from the snowfields and right through the town. And I'm telling you, that water, I mean, we were swimming quite a bit in the lakes and, you know, on the way around Mount Shasta and everything. And the water was chilly, but it wasn't bad. But I'm telling you, that creek, that must have been in the low 40s. It was freezing. It was just absolute ice water. It was great. I mean, we went in it every day. But, yeah, we really enjoyed that. And then on up to Eugene. And Eugene has a... and I was also on two radio programs, which was very nice. The actual, and you can see that in the resources, the main Southern Oregon, Northern California radio station, which is an NPR, and actually it's a public radio, it's not really, I don't know if it's NPR, but it's a public radio, publicly funded, and gosh, they had a great interview, really, the guy was fantastic. So, if you have a chance, I think you might enjoy listening to that interview, because it was really well done, and they wrote about it, they gave it a good write-up, too. And so I feel like we reached, you know, thousands of people that way, as well as another one, Carol Rosen, who's an old friend of ours on American Freedom Radio, had me on for a whole hour, or 2 hours, actually, talking about the World Peace Diet and the importance of spiritual-based consciousness and awareness of our devastation of animals. And that goes out, she says she has hundreds of thousands, I don't know, of listeners all over the world, maybe, or half a million or a million. She was even sometimes saying she thinks it goes up to a million. So, I'm not sure, those are always, I think, for anyone, any of you who are wanting to reach out, if you can get, you have a chance sometime to share on either a local radio station or on internet radio podcast type things that are, there's really so many of them nowadays. It's a good way, I think. People are interested in this message, and there's all kinds of angles. Like, we have a friend, you know, he's not a well-known writer or anything, but he's a vegan, and he lives in Petaluma. His name is Ray Cooper. He started something called Veg Curious, where it's just a once-a-month lecture in Petaluma on veganism. He's a vegan author there, and he just wanted to do something to help spread the message, and it's really, you know, going very well. He also loves to hike, and right now he's spending, I think, about 2.5 months or 3 months in Scotland, walking all the way from the north of Scotland down to southern England on these little pathways, and he's getting lost half the time. I think it's very difficult. It's not like being on the Appalachian Trail or something. There's lots of little, but he's having a great time, and he's got a vegan stickers on his backpack, and he's sharing the vegan message kind of in a grassroots way as he walks along. And, that's his way of sharing the message. But he also has been interviewed on some of the local radio stations in Sonoma County and Santa Rosa and Sebastopol, just about, you know, his walk and veganism and so forth. And I think it's good to remember that we don't have to be some, you know, world famous person to be on the radio. I mean, they always need programming, and we can, you know, put it out there and maybe get on. So anyway, we did that in Ashland. Eugene is really a wonderful city for vegans. They have a group called EVEN, which is Eugene Veg Education Network, EVEN, headed by Lynn Sullivan, who is, to me, one of the many fabulous grassroots activists. And I always say, I think the lifeblood of our movement is the grassroots, much more than the large organizations, which I guess have a role to play, of course, in any movement, this large national organizations. But we have to be very careful of them, because the organizations tend to become more interested in themselves and their fundraising and their victory, so-called, so they can make more money, and tend to sometimes to siphon off funds that would otherwise go to local groups, where there's really the possibility for mentoring and for putting on events and really bringing, you know, education, grassroots education. So not to say that they don't do some good work. They do. I think they do some good work for sure. But it was a great event. I mean, she really worked hard promoting it, unusually hard, I think, and we had a great turnout. The room was standing room only at the library, and it was a pretty big room. It was probably 150 people or so were there, and they did a video of it, so you can watch the video online if you want. They did a nice, I haven't watched it, but in the beginning looks good. And so that was a great event, and I think, you know, I'll just mention this old joke that my Zen teacher told me once, which I think it's somewhat apropos to what I was just saying. He said that once the devil was walking along around on the earth, just kind of looking things over and seeing how things were going here, and he was with his assistant, and they were walking around, and at one point they saw this box on the ground, and the assistant went over and picked it up and looked inside the box, and inside the box was the truth. And so the assistant said, uh-oh, you know, we better hide this box. I mean, this is the truth in here. And if people discover this box that has the truth, you know, we'll be out of business. And then the devil said, just leave it there. If they find it, they'll organize it. They'll just organize it. So, you know, my old Zen teacher used to think that was a great joke, and I think it is pretty funny in a way, because it's true. Very often we do end up organizing the visions of luminaries. Charles and Merle Fillmore, the co-founders of Unity, are, I think, a good example. I mean, Unity is a great organization, but their whole vegan message in many ways got pushed away by the organization as the decades went by. And this, I think it's happened with Christianity too and many other traditions. But anyway, so, and then we went on up to Portland and had events there. And we were, let's see, what else? We basically did something we'd never done. We had to actually cancel a couple of events because we had to come back. I had to have a little work done on my eye, which went just fine. And then Madeline stayed here. I went to, just recently, to a conference in Chicago. I just got back, actually. It was, it was last weekend. And it was on eco-spirituality. It was at the Theosophical Society headquarters. And this was also very instructive. I don't know if you've heard of the Theosophical Society, any of you know of the Theosophical Society, but it's a pretty in its time, it was very influential. It was founded back in the late 1800s by a visionary psychic, very interesting woman named Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, HPB, she was known, and she, from Russia, and but she traveled a lot in India and Tibet, and was initiated into sort of the Buddhist teachings way back before anybody knew much about them, and apparently also met these beings called ascended masters who live far up in the mountains, and they're sort of they're great bodhisattvas who are considered sort of the elder brothers of the race. And she wrote about some of their teachings and a book called Voice of the Silence and many other books, actually. And so a whole organization grew up around her and some of these teachings that were coming through that she was sort of channeling, I guess you'd say. She'd kind of pick up on these ideas and through her studies and through these masters in the Himalayas. And one of their main teachings was vegetarianism. The vegetarian, like the Theosophical Society, has branches all over the world. You know, it's called an American section. There's France, Germany, England, Australia, India. And the international headquarters is in Adyar, India. And so once a year here in the big headquarters is in Wheaton, Illinois. It's a really beautiful, beautiful, beautiful place. It's outside the city. I guess when they first built it 100 years ago, it was sort of out in the fields, and now it's sort of surrounded. But it's big. It's probably, I don't know what, 30 acres of land or so, and lots of trees and gardens and forests and everything. And they're really into the living spirits of nature. You know, they're really into devas and nature spirits and fairies and all, you know, all these different levels of consciousness and all that stuff. It's part of the Theosophical material. In fact, when I first started, way back when I left home with my brother and we walked all the way to Alabama, and in Alabama, we were living in a Zen monastery, a Zen center there. We were meditating every day, about 8 or 10 hours a day. I remember getting up at 6. We'd meditate from 6 until 11, have 3 hours for lunch and a break and yoga, and then we would meditate again from 2 to 5, and then we'd meditate again in the evening, usually from 7 to 9. And we did that for quite a few months, and then the Zen teacher from California, Oakland, California, came to visit and give teachings, and his assistant, a woman from Atlanta, also came, and she was a Theosophist, and actually he was also a Theosophist. He had studied Theosophy. In fact, he, my old Zen teacher, had his mother had been into Theosophy way back in the 1930s. When he was born in 1909, so he was a kid in the 20s. His mother had this book that was a theosophical book with some of the yoga practices, I guess, from India. And he was an interest. He was like maybe 13 years old, and he was very interested in. He kind of looked at this secret book that she'd kind of had it hidden away, you know. So of course, he really wanted to read it. And so he read, and it talked about how you can do these meditation practices with breathing, pranayama, various things. And so he worked on that every day. He'd come home from school, and he'd work and work and work. He said he just worked so hard doing these practices. And one day, the practice was a success. And he said it was an amazing experience for a 13-year-old kid. Suddenly, it was like his whole mind just opened up. And he saw this cosmic level of awareness and of reality, and he heard music that was music that is unlike anything anyone can ever hear on this earth. It was so beautiful, and it was glorious. And he said after that, he was walking on air for a few days, just realizing that there's much more to this world than meets the eye. And so that was his start in theosophy. And he was a theosophist, you know, for like, he didn't die until he was 95. And he and I used to go together, actually, to the theosophical regular meetings in Oakland. We'd bring his mother. She was in her 90s. And we all go, the three of us would go to the meetings and talk about theosophical ideas. This is way back when I was in my 20s. And living in Oakland, studying with him, so that's like 40 years ago. But I think it was really neat. So for me, I've actually been a member for about 40 years of the Theosophical Society. I joined way back then, and so he and this other woman back in Huntsville, she was also a Theosophist. They really wanted me to read all these basic books, and I did. I remember reading. That was like one of the first books I read. You know, you've probably heard of Autobiography of the Yogi. You know, some of these books everybody reads, but the Theosophical Society has books on the subtle realms, like the book called The Astral Body, it's one called The Mental Body, one called The Causal Body, one called The Etheric Double. Anyway, the whole idea is to, and a lot of the people are somewhat psychic or intuitive, they can see auras and things like that, and there was a woman there that, you know, this past couple of days ago when I was there, who was telling us about what she sees and the auras that she saw and the devas in the trees and the spirits, the nature spirits that are helping everything to grow, and that through all these, this is something she's lived with her whole life. She's just been able to see these beings since she was a little girl, and it's been hard for her sometimes because people thought she was kind of nutty, but she, you know, she was herself was raised in a theosophical family, so she had support for that, and anyway, it was kind of interesting to hear, her what she was saying, and to be at the headquarters, and so they were having this conference on eco spirituality, and they paid me to come and speak. They paid my flight and everything else, and to come and I was one of four main speakers at this gathering, and I was the only one who talked about veganism. The other ones didn't talk about that at all, although one of them was pretty much a vegan, I think. The other two were vegetarians. And so my mission while I was there, it seemed to me, was to try to bring the vegan message to these people who are already vegetarian. They're very good vegetarians, you know. They've been vegetarians. They actually were instrumental in bringing vegetarianism to the West. They were very instrumental. They were probably the first ones to actually do it. I mean, Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society were really the first ones to bring Buddhism to the West back in the 1890s and set up these societies. And it was theosophists very often that created the first Buddhist societies. The Buddhist Society in England was Christmas Humphreys, he was a theosophist, and all these people, they were all theosophists. And Sri Lanka, they brought Buddhism back to Sri Lanka. It had died out there and brought it back to life. And they brought vegetarianism to the Western world. It had been pretty much, they were the main influences to get it going back in the late 1800s. And so I love that. I think it's great that they did that. And they're now, you know, unfortunately it's a relatively small organization. It doesn't have many members anymore. It's had its flowering you know, maybe 60 or 70 or 80 or a year or 100 years ago. And now it's more older people, but they're still going along. And I, you know, the whole idea is, from my point of view, if they want to be more relevant, is that they should get off of just being vegetarian and go vegan and bring that message to their members and to the world as part of their teaching. And so I talked about that for my times. I had, you know, giving a lecture, and I also gave a concert. And I think it went really well, I have to say. I mean, they are used to serving in their cafeteria, and I've spent a lot of time there. Madeline and I would go there when we lived on the road in the RV. She would fly to Switzerland, and I very often would spend the summer in the north somewhere, sometimes in New England, but sometimes in the Midwest. And if it was the Midwest, she flew out of Chicago, I would spend a few weeks parked in my RV at Alcott, which is the headquarters that I mentioned in the United States for the Sea South Coast Society, this beautiful place with owls and rabbits and lots of wildlife. And it's just a beautiful, like a little paradise, and with an amazing library of metaphysical books, probably one of the biggest in the country. And but I, you know, I ate in the cafeteria pretty much every day, had lunch with the people. And there was always some eggs, there was always dairy. They really, I could always get vegan food, but they really were not at all into being vegan. And so the good news was that after my talk was over, there was a couple other people that were vegans, that were like vegan advocates, like activists like me, that were just there attending, not speaking. And one was really a pretty neat guy from Costa Rica, and who's been there for many years and who's working to bring the vegan message in Costa Rica. And he told me that at my concert, that the new president, she's brand new as a new president now at the American section, that she said, we've got to do this. We've got to go vegan as a society. So I'm really delighted to hear that maybe they'll be able to move in that direction and maybe begin to do some leadership, because I've seen this happen before. It was great to see how, for example, Thich Nhat Hanh, his whole movement was just vegetarian, typical Buddhist vegetarian kind of a thing with dairy and eggs, like always. And when he said, all right, we're going vegan, it just really, I think, catapulted their movement. It got much stronger, and it's much more, you know, standing for something, and doesn't have this terrible inconsistency going on, like the Unitarians. Everybody has this, you know, this inconsistency. So Pure Master King Pai also, and Food Not Bombs. I mean, these are really vegan organizations that I think are much stronger because they are vegan. And in the early days, they might not have been completely vegan, but then they moved over and said, okay, we're going to stand with veganism. And I think it's helped them. So that just happened this past weekend, and there were some other events, smaller events in between, some online events and some other things. But Madeline and I were on Lily's call, I remember, in early July. But the Theosophical movement, I think it'll be great if they, even though they're not that well known, they have a kind of a keystone position, I think, on some level, where they're quite influential. There's a lot of people who are versed in things, who are aware of them, and so I do hope that they make progress. And I'll keep following up on that. And then this coming, somebody wanted me to talk about this. Someone asked me to talk about this, so I'll mention this briefly. The day after tomorrow, on Saturday, there's going to be the march to close all slaughterhouses in San Francisco. And I've been asked to speak at that. And so that's going to be like at 10 o'clock at Union Square. People are gathering. And then there's a march for about a mile to the United Nations Plaza, which is near the Civic Center. And then there'll be lectures. And I believe the lectures are being they're held there. I'm going to be speaking. Wayne Hsiung, H-S-I-U-N-G, Wayne Hsiung, who's basically the founder of Direct Action Everywhere, DXC, he'll be speaking. And then Miyoko Shinner, who I just talked about, the founder of Miyoko's Creamery and of the Sanctuary, she'll be speaking. And there's a few other people also speaking who I'm not familiar with, like Zoe, a couple of people. I don't have it right in front of me, the people, the speakers, for some reason I can't remember. But anyway, there'll be some speakers at probably around noon. And the nice thing about this, I think, about this gathering is that it's being co-sponsored by a number of groups. I mean, look at this list of people that are sponsoring this march. PETA, the Humane League, Vegan Outreach, Animal Place, Factory Farming Awareness Coalition, Direct Action Everywhere, Happy Hand Chicken Rescue in Defense of Animals, Berkeley Organization for Animal Advocacy, Bay Area Animal Save, Women Against Speciesism, Jewish Veg, United Poultry Concerns, Center for Animal Protection and Education, Compassionate Living, and you know, quite a few more, actually. So some of these are some pretty major groups. So it's nice to see the groups, both large, big national groups, but also a lot of the local grassroots groups, all working together in this case to sponsor this event. And the March to Close All Slaughterhouses is actually part of a larger movement of marches in cities. I think there's been one in New York City. I think there's been one in, I think it started maybe in Spain. I'm not sure, but it's an international movement. It started in another country, and now it's moving worldwide. And so local groups are having marches to close all slaughterhouses. So that's the idea. And I think Direct Action Everywhere is probably the main organizer of this, I believe. I think they really did a lot of the heavy lifting to really make this happen. And I have to say, they're really very active. Of course, I'm here in the Bay Area. This is their headquarters, and they recently had a training here that apparently a lot happened with marches and a whole event in Whole Foods and all kinds of direct action they were doing. But anyway, I think it's great, actually, to see that kind of working together on an actual event for the public, not just a conference, you know, like the Animal Rights Conference, which is sort of a conference just for animal rights people, but something that's actually going to get press and it's going to be live streamed, and there's going to be, I'm sure there'll be, I mean, I don't know how many people are going to be there, but there's over 1,000 people have said they're going to be there on Facebook, so I think there'll be a few thousand people probably. So if you're in the area, Saturday is the place to be, San Francisco. And I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, my main emphasis really, obviously, is education and helping people to understand the deeper consequences of animal agriculture. And this is more of education too, though. I mean, it's a march with speakers, and it's making a public statement, and it's totally nonviolent. There's no, you know, it's peaceful and so forth. So I think this is the kind of thing that can also be very helpful to help raise awareness of people who will come to this, or if they read about it or hear about it on the radio or television. So that's that, and then I also wanted to just mention, I wanted to actually have a couple of people on the call in a minute, but so far I don't see anybody raising their hand. So remember, everyone, if you want to raise your hand, press *6. If you want to have any question about anything I'm talking about, or if you want to pitch in something, feel free to press *6. But the other thing I wanted to just go over, there's a few things maybe, but just briefly to talk a little bit about the article I just wrote, because that's really gotten quite a lot of, I don't know, the word I guess they use is buzz. You know, people are really talking about it and sharing it around and the various forms and things. And the article is called, the title of it is, "Whenever We Eat Animal Foods, We Are Being Exploited." So I hope you've all had a chance to read it. I failed, for some reason, it was an oversight on my part, to to list it on July's resources. I meant to, and somehow I didn't. So maybe I'll just, but you can just go to willpreestack.com and just click on Will's essays, click on current essays. It's right there. It's my current essay. I just posted it a few days ago. And I just think that this is really a key concept that has not been talked about enough, and probably not talked about at all, actually, in our movement, the movement to liberate animals, which is the fact that, and I mean, the very first paragraph kind of sums it up, and this is it. The most obvious and non-controversial characteristic of animal agriculture is that it is a system in which humans exploit animals for food. The vast majority of us go along with the internalized cultural narratives that justify this exploitation. We don't realize that we are also being abused and exploited by the same system that is exploiting the cows, chickens, fishes, and pigs. All right, so that's basically it. That no one will argue, whether they're big meat eaters or not, I don't think anyone will argue that animal agriculture is a system in which humans exploit animals for food. I mean, you know, that's, you may say, well, I love bacon, or animals don't have a soul, or whatever, but you can't argue that we're not exploiting animals for food in animal agriculture, that our society does that on a massive scale. Both vegans and non-vegans would agree with that. Non-vegans might say, well, yeah, but it's not a big deal, you know, because animals are inferior, so. But in any event, we are certainly imprisoning them, we are stealing their babies, we are killing them, and we are certainly exploiting them. And I don't think we would get any argument from people on that. That's something that we understand at a deep level. And so to help people realize that we go along with the internalized cultural narrative that allows and fuels this exploitation, and that if we look carefully, we can see very clearly that this system that's exploiting animals on a massive scale is also exploiting us, and that if we're eating animal foods, we are being exploited. And I just haven't seen anyone writing about this or talking about this, really. And it's been coming. It came to me. I mean, it's in the World Peace Diet, but not this explicitly in this crystal clarity. You know, this kind of clarity. Because as I was giving lectures, one of the things that really struck me was the fact that these animals that we're eating are being forced to eat food that is not their natural food. None of them are eating their natural food. And this is exactly what's happening to us. In the essay, I give the example of cows as a profoundly relevant example. I'll read it. I mean, it says, cows are clearly designed to thrive on grass, but they are fed richer and more complex grains such as soy, corn, oats, wheat, and alfalfa in order to boost milk production in dairies and increase weight gain in beef operations. So that's the basic thing. They're fed these grains to boost their output and the profits for the operators, and they don't stop there. They feed cows meat. Which is, you know, if you think about it, that's ridiculous. You know, who would ever think of a cow as a carnivore? I mean, this is the thing. You know, this is something we can really use in our advocacy with people. Are cows carnivore? People say, well, we're carnivores. You know, we're omnivores. You could say, well, are cows omnivores? Most people would not say that cows are omnivores. Cows are not typically seen catching fish or catching chickens or eating other cows, cannibalizing other cows. This is not something that ever happens, ever, in nature. I mean, it would never happen. This is they have, you know, four stomachs to digest grass. So they're designed for grass, and yet we make them very sick. Feeding them grain causes E. coli, which is, you know, causes us to be sick. But then we feed them fish meal, and we feed them chicken, and pig, rendered, products, meat and offal from the slaughterhouses, dogs and cats, everything, you know, gets sent to the renderer, ground up, fed to livestock. Cows, pigs and chickens are all eating this stuff. Cows, well understood, cows for decades were eating other cows. Until that was discovered to cause mad cow disease. Now they're not supposed to do it anymore, and whether that's really, it's not even checked. They don't even check, so you should, no one doubts, really, I don't think, that people are still getting mad cow disease. But in any event, the cows are eating meat as well as grain, and they're eating, and so the basic idea is they are not eating these foods because they like it, or because the people who are feeding them want to be generous and give them rich food because they're feeling very loving to them. They're doing it because they're exploiting them. They're feeding them food that makes them sick, because when they're sick, they make more money. Not the fact that they're sick, but when they're sick, in terms of getting fat, in terms of giving a lot more milk than they normally would, getting very large udders that are swollen and filled with milk, because you got to feed a cow a lot of fat and cholesterol to give a lot of milk, and they don't get that. If they're eating grass, they're not going to give very much milk, and they're not going to fatten up unless you feed them this rich feed, and they enrich it with all kinds of stuff. So that's the basic principle involved, that the exploiting industries, the pharmaceutical industry, the fast food industry, the agriculture industry, chemical industry, fertilizer industry, these are gigantic, powerful industries, big agribusiness, big pharma, and the big food industries, they thrive at this point on people getting eating this food and really in many ways getting addicted to it. And so the system is exploiting cows and also pigs. The same thing happening with pigs and chickens, all the other animals. They're eating also the same, doing the same thing. They're eating food they would never eat, grains and things they would never eat, and meat they would never eat, and to fatten them up and all that. So this is industry-wide practice, and people eat this stuff. And so I just point out that on all five levels of health, we are being exploited. We're being exploited environmentally, because animal agriculture is destroying our environment, and the pharmaceutical industry has over 10,000 different drugs that are used on animals. All that ends up in the environment too. It ends up in the water. It's causing devastation. All this is causing devastation to our climate, to oceans, to rainforests, to the health of our ecosystems. And so cancer is skyrocketing. People are eating, polluted, toxic food and water and air. And all these things make people sicker. And, you've got to understand, these are huge industries that profit. The cancer industry is like $300 or $400 billion industry a year. You think they really want a cure for cancer? I mean, they make money on people getting cancer. And so agriculture, by polluting the environment, creates a foundation for more profitability for these industries, and we get exploited, on many levels. Not only are impoverished people having to live very often directly, close to these horribly toxic operations, and those people, it's well understood, there's been so many studies done that people living near factory farms and feedlots and so forth have much higher rates of respiratory diseases and many other diseases, from their water being polluted, cancer and so forth, their air being polluted from these operations. But all of us suffer. When the environments are polluted, we all suffer from that. And wherever we are, even if we're not living close to it. So that's the environmental level. The cultural level, of course, is something that's pretty obvious too, because animal agriculture causes starvation, hunger, leading to conflict and war, which are, again, profitable for industries, and, again, that's not good for us. Right now, I just read the other day, I'm sure you're all aware of it, over half of all of our money from our taxes and everything is going directly to the military. We're spending trillions of dollars on the military. We're spending, we say we have these enemies like Russia and China. We're spending, 10 or 15 times as much on our military than they are, and we're instead of using our money to improve the environment and housing and healthcare and education and social programs, or to, you know, or environmental cleanup or whatever, something to do something good, we're spending on bombs and utter horror. And so we're being exploited by, we're directly being exploited by that. And that's a direct harm to the people from, you know, as we exploit these animals, we're getting exploited, and it's happening on every level. You know, it's obvious. The other ones are obvious. I mean, it's like, you know, physically, we make them sick, and we get our physical health gets destroyed. We're getting exploited. People, you know, are lining up for prostate cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, heart disease, liver disease, kidney disease, diabetes. I don't have to go into it. They're all driven by animal agriculture. So if we're eating animal foods, we're being exploited that way. It's very clear as well. And then psychologically and spiritually, those are the other two levels. The drugs that people are taking for their insomnia and chronic pain and depression, you know, the same industries are making profits, huge profits. And people are eating the animals that have these conditions. And so as we sow, we're reaping. If we exploit these animals psychologically, we find we're getting exploited psychologically. But we are getting exploited psychologically. You have to realize the media is not telling us the truth, that we're being continually bombarded with lies about foreign policy, about domestic policy, about health, pretty much about everything. And so we're being exploited psychologically, as well as physically, as well as environmentally, culturally, and then spiritually. And that has to do with our ethics and the fact that animal agriculture essentially teaches us or injects into us this delusion that we're just material things, just objects that we're born and will die, and that we're like cows and pigs and chickens. You know, they're just objects that we're born and will die, and they're just, you know, they're just things. We just sell them by the pound. And when we reduce them to mere objects to be exploited, what happens to us? We get reduced to mere objects to be exploited, and that's what's happening to us, and we don't see it. So I think, quite honestly, the in many ways, the frontier of our movement for as far as successfully transforming the psychology of people so they become more empowered to be effective, not only effective advocates, but actually to move to a plant-based way of eating, is to show them or to just share. I think it's always good to share the fact that I'm so glad that I discovered, you know, this discovery, that the only reason I was eating animal foods was because I was following orders that I never freely chose. No one ever freely chooses to eat animal foods. We do it because we're born into a society where the people who indoctrinate us, and indoctrination happens in any society, it's not necessarily a bad thing, it's a socialization process. Our parents, teachers, ministers, doctors, the government, you know, they all essentially program us to eat animal foods, and it's not in our best interest. It's done without our permission, and we're directly exploited by that. When people do not want to be exploited, they don't mind, you know, I don't think, I mean, numbing themselves to the point where they're killing and using other animals, but when people see that they're being exploited, I think, I've seen this in my own advocacy, that very often that is the thing that will make them, okay, I'm done with it. I'm not going to eat these foods anymore because I can see I'm being exploited when I do it. And so I'm hoping that this meme, I guess as you call it, a meme, that when we eat animals and when we exploit animals, we're being exploited. This to me is pure dynamite in terms of just going to the core root of the dilemma and exploding it. And I think if that gets any traction in our society, we're going to see massive changes. And already we're seeing massive changes. It's great to see there's this it's going to be in next month. It just came out today. I just found out about it today. There's this article in Harvard Magazine, the magazine from Harvard University. And it's very interesting, you know, it's the rise of the vegan culture. You know, and I think this is something that it's an idea whose time has come, in a sense, that we have a magazine like Harvard Magazine, which is far from, you know, far from being an alternative magazine. It's a very mainstream magazine. And the very, look at this. I mean, this is the very first paragraph. Distant are the days of Annie Hall when Woody Allen resigned himself to a plate of alfalfa sprouts and mashed yeast. Over the years, vegan eating has gone from tasteless to trendy, to making inroads into the mainstream. One sign of the times in 2016, Tyson Foods, the largest meat processor in the United States, bought a 5% stake in the plant-based protein producer Beyond Meat. No longer fettered by associations with hippie kooks or radical politics, veganism has ascended to the astral plane of aspirational living. These days, it keeps mixed and more glamorous company. Famous bodies belonging to the likes of Tom Brady and Beyoncé have been fueled by vegan diets. I mean, this is quite something. And the article, I mean, I think it's so funny. I'm just talking about the Theosophical Society. I mean, they were the ones who basically invented, popularized the term astral, like the astral plane. And she's using that here now. I mean, this is so interesting. I mean, she doesn't even know what it is, I don't think, but, you know, the idea that, you know, there's some other plane of reality that's a higher level. So, you know, the article goes on and talks about social scientists studying veganism and seeing that it's going through all these deep changes and becoming actually a part of emerging society that, you know, it's very powerful, and it's much more than just being healthy. It's a lifestyle movement. So, so that's, I guess, the whole thing is that we're seeing that there's progress, enormous progress being made, and I think we can see much more progress being made that will be made as we can understand the significance of these ideas and share them with other people and celebrate the fact that we're, as vegans, we're not only liberating animals, we're liberating ourselves from the suffering and misery of being exploited by absolutely merciless corporations and institutions who think only really in terms of dollar signs. And we become commodities ourselves if we're commodifying animals. So this is a liberation. And when people understand this, I think our movement will grow much more quickly. And I think younger people are definitely making it that way. And politically, oh, I know Clifton Roberts. That's what I was going to say. Clifton Roberts, who ran for president of the Humane Party, he will be speaking on Saturday also. With me at the and a few other people at this march to close all slaughterhouses in San Francisco, and they just have a new study, the Humane Party. Catherine Perry just sent me a link to it. It'll be in next month's resources too, but it's easy to find. Basically, just comparing animal agriculture and plant agriculture, and how plant agriculture not only uses less resources to feed people than animal agriculture, but it's also more profitable for the industries, for the businesses. They actually make more profit per sale, per level of amount of money in sales, and also as a percentage of income, and also as a percentage of return on investment for stockholders. So I think it's a lot of good news here that, you know, animal-based, and this is with animal agriculture getting all these subsidies from the government. They're even less profitable, actually. So I think, besides being devastating and destructive, I think, you know, it's well known that dairies are having a heck of a time. They're losing money. I mean, we have to, taxpayer money is bailing out these industries. There's much more, you know, the future is with plant-based foods on every level, in terms of not only economics, but especially, I think, obviously, in terms of psychology, spirituality, and health. And we're seeing this becoming more and more obvious, I think, all the time. All right, so those are the main things I wanted to say. There's a couple of people I'd like to call on. But first, actually, Marlene, hi. Marlene has raised her hand. Marlene Nero, as many of you know, is a wealthy facilitator who's wonderful, dedicated activist and has a Vegan Nation radio program, a weekly radio program in Massachusetts. And Marlene, I'm going to unmute your phone. So if you want to say something. Hello.
Hi, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Good to hear your voice.
Yes, and two things. One, I just want to say tomorrow's Vegan Nation show, thanks for saying it, is featuring the San Francisco March to Close All Slaughterhouses. And my interviewee is Diane Gandy Sorby, who's in Redwood City, who is a member of Direct Action Everywhere.
Great, Diane. Okay.
DXC.
So you're going to interview her tomorrow, Friday, right, leading up to it. Friday at noon, right, I think.
Yes, 12:30, wcuw.org. That's CU like Clark University, wcuw.org. You can listen 12:30 to 1 Eastern time, so that's 9:30 your time.
9:30 in California, right. Great. All right, I'll make a note of that. Yeah.
And so I did have a question.
Yes.
And I'm going to frame this in retrospect to one of my guests on Vegan Nation. His name is Harrison Nathan, and he's in Boston, Massachusetts, and he has an organization called Anti-Slaughter Network and also Reduce the Excuses. And he's been doing a lot of research following the large animal corporations, as you mentioned earlier, and that he's under the understanding now that it really needs to be a split between the animal welfare and the animal rights, because in his research, he's finding a lot of connections, I guess you can say, to the industry, the money, following the money, and that it's really, I see it confusing and really splitting. So, for example, last year, 2016, Open Philanthropy Project awarded $3 million, $1 million to Mercy for Animals, $1 million to the Humane League, and $1 million to Humane Society of the United States to promote cage-free eggs. And so, of course, that's not promoting veganism. That's promoting an animal-based diet and the illusion of the cage-free eggs, which we all know that that's not compassion in any way, yet that's what's being delivered. And I see a lot of vegans getting on two different sides of the fence over this, and I would like your opinion on it. And so that was my main question with that. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Marlene. I really appreciate your bringing that question up. And yeah, that's something that we have found is a problem in our movement, and I think it's not just our movement. I think it's the environmental movement. A lot of movements do get watered down and fragmented by money that comes from, I'm not sure, I mean, whether they're well-meaning foundations, maybe they are, or maybe there's actually people behind there that have an agenda to cause fragmentation within our movement. It's hard to say, but the Open Philanthropy Project, which gave $1 million to Mercy for Animals, to Humane League, and to HSUS to promote cage-free eggs, maybe the people there just thought, you know, like a lot of people are saying, you know, like even vegans, so-called vegans, are saying, you know, we shouldn't really promote veganism. It's too kind of extreme. We should promote reducitarianism. If people can just reduce the amount of animals they're eating, that's the way forward. And part of that would be if they can also modulate what they're buying. So it would be better, for example, if they would buy cage-free eggs than buying standard eggs. It would be better if they would buy grass-fed beef and beef. It would be better if they would buy organic meat and dairy instead of the commercial one. Get rid of, you know, factory farming is the worst problem. So that kind of messaging is disturbing, I think, for us if we're in this really primarily for the animals, because it creates this whole sense that eating animal foods is fine. In fact, in many ways, it's better than going vegan, because if we're buying these foods, we're supporting people who are trying to make a positive difference. You know, they're trying to raise their their hens more humanely, and they're trying to slaughter them more humanely, and we should really support them. And it also, of course, plays into the hands of people who don't really want to be different. I mean, I think that's a big problem in a way, is that a lot of people don't really want to be different from other people. They don't want to have this, the social challenges that come with going 100% vegan or animal-free when, like, Thanksgiving or any time when people are eating typical foods, and then the person who's committed to veganism has to bring their own food or has to say something like, sorry, everybody, I'm not going to eat this. Can you make, get something special for me or whatever? It's like an awkward thing. It's sort of tribal. We're not part of the tribe anymore. We're not eating the tribe's food. We're eating our own food. So we're not part of the tribe, and everybody in the tribe looks at us with hostility and suspicion. A lot of people just cannot tolerate that. And so this messaging from the large organizations, typically, especially those three that you mentioned, I think does create a problem for really the movement to liberate animals, because it dilutes the message and causes a lot of infighting, and people feel betrayed because I used to give money to Mercy for Animals, and now I don't give it anymore because now they're doing this. And a lot of people say that, I don't want to support them, and then I think there's a lot of potential conflicts of interest. One of the things, for example, I've noticed is there's a real emphasis in these larger groups to use research, to do market research, to find out what types of messaging is most effective. And so people are basically, grassroots activists are basically being told, don't trust your own instincts, your own intuition, or your own capacities. We are doing studies, and we're the experts, and we will tell you what's the most effective messaging, what kind of words you should use, what kind of messages you should use based on our market research. And from my point of view, having gone through a PhD program at Berkeley and studied quantitative and qualitative analysis methods and research methodologies and so forth, I don't think these people know what the heck they're doing at all. They're not trained. They're very gullible and naive in many ways. They invariably, seems to me, come up with research that is in their interest. It's like the research is saying basically that I keep hearing it's like 80% of the people who go they say 80% of the people who go veg go back again to eating meat. First of all, they say veg, like, what's that? That's not vegan anyway. And then the basic message is that, people don't stick with it. So you might as well not try to convert anybody because they don't stick with it, so don't worry about it. Just do the reducitarian thing and the free-range thing. And so this actually strengthens the industries in many ways. It causes confusion. It sows seeds of doubt. People are wondering, what's the best thing? Well, maybe it's fine. It's good. What the heck? And that's all you need to do. If you see that movie, which I highly recommend, What the Health, Michael Greger makes that point that the tobacco industry, all I needed to do for all those decades was just sow seeds of doubt. Even though it was obvious that tobacco was devastating to people's health, if they could just sow seeds of doubt, they could go on for decades and decades. And they would still be going if it wasn't for the fact that there were some very dedicated activists who were able to finally, break through some of that, those tactics. But the same tactics are being used now by the industry to sow seeds of doubt. It's very obvious that animal foods are devastating to our health and to the animals and to the environment. But by sowing seeds of doubt and offering money and using these large organizations, which in a sense have more of a commitment, I think, to their own existence, profitable existence, and so their messaging tends to be much more mainstream, much more like what the average person wants to hear. And if the average person wants to hear that cage-free eggs are a great way to go, and then that's a win-win-win, right? It's a win-win for the for the organization. They make more money, they make more donations. The person gets to eat the eggs. It's the only ones who lose are the chickens and everybody else, really, ultimately. So I think, you know, I think he's right what he's saying. This is an ongoing issue. And it's one of the reasons, quite honestly, I have mixed feelings about attending the animal rights conferences lately, the last 2 years, because these organizations have such a powerful presence there, and they kind of run them. And I went a few years ago, and I actually moderated the debate between Bruce Friedrich and Gary Francione, and where they were talking about this. This is like the big debate, you know, and it's still... You know, the debate is still going on, but it's sort of gone underground, I think, for the most part. And I think it's important to just really keep asking these questions. But then on the other hand, you know, each one of us can do our own activism. Like, I would love to, I think Lily's here. I would like to unmute Lily's phone because she left me a message actually earlier today. I think this is the kind of grassroots activism that is so helpful. You know, we don't have to worry. I mean, whatever these big organizations do, if they do things we don't like or not, I mean, we can criticize them if we want to. Or on the other hand, like I always say, if you don't like what the Humane Society is doing, you don't like what they're doing, you'd say, okay, and then you're God and you can destroy them, so you destroy them. The fact is that within a month, they'll be right back again, you know, because there are literally millions of people who eat meat and dairy, who love dogs and cats, and who want an organization that they can give money to protect animals that will not really cause them to look any deeper than that, you know, too much. So, you know, it's an arising in our society that's very well, you know, it's just going to happen. So, you know, we don't have to fight against it. We should just understand that there's going to be these kinds of organizations. Because there's a lot of people that would like to support them. But we have our job to do. So anyway, Lily, I'd like to, if you don't mind, I'm going to unmute your phone if you're there. And if you could just share, I think it'd be nice if you could share a little bit your story that you told on your message. I think that was very interesting. Are you there?
I wasn't expecting you to call on me. We're having our dinner, but it's okay.
Uh-oh.
You know, it's just okay. Something I do every day. Every day that I can, and since I'm not on the internet, actually, it has served me very, very well because I have to do all of my business on the phone. And in a way, anybody can do that, you know, if they want to do a little activism. But what I look for is a person who demonstrates some aliveness in their voice. If they don't sound like a robot or an automaton, then what I usually kind of work toward the end of the conversation, it'll usually be something like this. They might say, is there anything else that we can do for you? And I said, well, actually there is. Have you ever heard of the World Peace Diet? Because I use the World Peace Diet as my tool of activism. It's so easy because the work has already been done. And 9 times out of 10, or maybe 99 times out of 100, really, people may say no, but they're interested. And today it was just marvelous because I think I was ordering some eye drops for my husband and from this male pharmacy, and I don't know how we got into it, but, you know, finally we came around to it, and because I liked her. I liked what she was. You know, I just liked the way she was interacting with me. It was fun. I make it fun. And I said, you know, I asked her about that, and I told her, I said, you know, my husband and I are quite well educated, and my husband even has an MD behind his name, but I want you to know that this particular book that I'm telling you about, if we had to get rid of all of our education and all the influences in our lives, we've had plenty. I had to pick one. This would be it. And I might put out the vegan message. I said it's all about why to go vegan. And the way it ended was she said, you know, I'm so glad that you talked to me, and I wound up singing to her too, and she said that was a first, because I actually wrote the words to Will Tuttle's duck song, and I started to sing it to her, because I said, you know, and she started to cry on the phone. It was so sweet. And she said, "I no one's ever sung to me before on this job." And I said, well, I'll tell you, going vegan just opens you up in such a way that you just feel one with people, and you can tell who they are. And I can tell, I know you're younger than I am. I can tell this, you know. I say various things to her, to the people. But I said, you know, but if you were my niece or my daughter, I would be treating you the same way. I would tell you, read the World Peace Diet. Take a look at the vegan message and the way it's stated in the World Peace Diet. It's so beautiful. Well, I had her repeating the website to me, and she got the telephone number for the World Peace Diet Sunday that I've been doing.
Great.
Now it's my fourth year of doing it, and she was very excited by it. And she said, "I'll never forget this day." It was so, it was beautiful because I empowered her for that day. I said, she said, have a wonderful day, Mrs. Macy.
Wow.
And I said, well, you have a wonderful day. And she said, well, you've made it more wonderful, and I'm definitely going to the website. And she told me, she promised me she'd come. You never know, but she said, I'll come to that. She told me they're having a picnic for the work this weekend. It's she's in Florida. And she said that it may still be going on because it goes in the, you know, to the late evening hours for her work. But she said she will come. She told me, and she was just, but it was really interesting how she burst into tears. And I said, you know, I knew that you had a heart for the animals. I knew that already.
Right.
I could hear it in your voice. And she said, oh, I do. And I said, really, it's really practicing the golden rule. And she said, I believe in that. I believe in that. So it was such a, I felt so, I'll tell you, the secret is, my secret is that I felt more empowered to go into the rest of my day with a joyousness that I never had before. Before I was vegan, I didn't have a way to go into my day more joyously. Just giving the message, just giving this message brings so much joy in my life. And I thanked her. I said, thank you for listening to me. And she said, oh, she said, I loved what you had to say. I loved it. So it's fun. I make it fun. I try to do this every day. If I have anybody I have to call me and I've never talked to them before, I leave them with the message. Some people are just absolutely, they're like ripe fruit, ready for the picking. And others are, you know, okay, I'll have a look at it. And I don't worry about that. I just keep doing it. And then suddenly a plum, a ripe, beautiful plum is dangling there. And she's going, I'm so glad you shared this with me. Beautiful.
Thank you. Wow.
And it's one person
great.
At
yeah.
a time. I was one person. I was just one person. And so was my husband. And we were reading the World Peace Diet together the time I became vegan.
Right, and look at all the ripples that have gone out from that. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Okay, well, thanks
Great.
For calling on me. I wasn't expecting
yes.
to share that, but I had so much joy in it, too. It just gave a lift to me because with this tragedy that's going on here on the planet, I just want to feel like I'm doing a little something every day. And I live so far away from humanity in a way that's good, but in a way I'm not, you know, I'm kind of out of contact. So this is my way of being in contact.
Right. Beautiful. All right, Lily, thanks.
Thanks.
Great. Give her a love to Jim. Thanks. Yeah, bye.
Thanks. Love to Madeline.
Yeah. So that was beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that, Lily. And we're getting kind of close to the time for us to begin to wrap it up. It's, you know, it's already 10:30, goodness gracious, in East Coast time. I did want to just give, if possible, a quick opportunity. Let me just see if... to Judy, but I'm trying to see. Judy, are you there? Maybe Judy was on the call earlier, I think, maybe. Let's see. Anyway, maybe that's Judy. Okay, just a second. Hello?
Will, can you hear me?
Yes. Oh,
hi. This is
okay,
Judy.
Good. Yeah, good.
Hi.
Wonderful.
Well,
great.
Yeah, we're getting low on time, but wow, so
yeah.
Much fascinating information. I wanted to say something about what you all were talking about with the co-opting of the groups and so forth.
Yeah.
This is not what I was going to talk about, but it's really relevant to what was just said. We had our first Veg Fest in Kansas City, and it was organized by a guy who's affiliated with HSUS. And we tried to suggest certain speakers, and that didn't work out. And one of my friends made up some flyers and was handing them out there, and I got a call from the organizer of the Veg Fest after the Veg Fest took place, and he asked me to tell her not to come back again. He's going to have
wow.
another Veg Fest, but he doesn't want her coming. And,
oh, no.
Of course, it's public property, and she, of course, has a right to do that. And
wow.
But I just was pretty shocked because, number one, there was a speaker there from HSUS who was saying it was better to eat one cow than 20 chickens.
Oh,
and,
no.
Yes, and this is a whole new thing. There's a video online about that. And,
right.
And then also the whole, yeah, take your time, eat humane meat, which there's no such thing. So it just really was startling how strong the pushback was for that. And so next year
right.
we're going to try to pay for a table and have mm-hmm. literature at the table. I don't know. We'll see.
Wow.
But real quick, you wanted me to talk a little bit about the vegan, Interfaith Vegan Coalition.
Right.
Lisa Levinson and I have started this. In Defense of Animals is helping us with it, with the website and all that stuff, which is wonderful of them to do that. But we are so excited because we've all been talking about this. You've been talking about this, how veganism is a part of our spirituality and our ethics, and yet there's so much pushback from the churches and people of faith, especially the Christian faith. And so a lot of people have given up trying to get through, but what we've got starting now, and the website is interfaithveganspirituality.com, and so you can go to that. It's definitely under construction, but we're going to talk about it some more at AR, at the Animal Rights Conference in D.C. And the thing that's so exciting is that there's so many people that are feeling like the time has finally come for churches and other places of faith to become open to this message, because it
right.
is the golden rule, and it's and there's people do love animals in general. They don't want to hurt animals, which means they're already vegan. They just don't know that they have to take it one step further and live. Their actions
right.
have to match their true values. And so we're feeling like this is really going to happen, and we're really going to start making inroads at this point. And I know you've done more work probably than anyone on reaching churches. What we've done with our volunteers is ask them, all different faiths, to give us a kit, to put together a kit that people can use so they can go to our website, and if they are let's say, Protestant, they can look up the Protestant kit and get ideas of what they could do specifically at their church to get this message across and to make their church go vegan, the whole church. And of course, you know, it may be that they feel like they can only approach maybe a small group of people and work from there. But at any rate, we're offering lists of books, websites, DVDs, and so forth that would be useful in introducing the concept and ultimately creating a church or any place of worship where there is no non-vegan food served, and no one wears fur, and the church functions don't involve circuses, fishing, etc., you know,
right,
family activities and so forth. I'm kind of rushing through it, but I encourage everybody to go to our website and kind of keep an eye on it, because it's going to keep growing. We've got lots of volunteers creating these kits for different religions, and even Hare Krishna, we have a kit for them now, and it's great. But it was interesting because the only change they really had to work on was the dairy, eliminating dairy, because they're basically, you know, so their foundation is so strong as far as
right,
ahimsa and caring about animals, but they do need to work on that. So so each kit is specifically designed
right.
Yeah. So
great.
I just wanted to share that with everybody.
Thank you so much, Judy. I know there was a few other things we were going to talk about, but I think at this point it's been over an hour and a half. So we can maybe continue next month.
Yeah, maybe next time. Okay.
All right.
Bless
you.
Thanks
so much.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.
Yeah, thanks so much. Bye. Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us. We've really pretty much come to the end of our time. I'll just say that please look at the resources for July of 2017. There's quite a few things at the beginning. Some of my interviews, also Marilyn was interviewed on the Conscious Connected Living podcast. Sandra Higgins is a great lecturer from Ireland. She's one of our facilitators. Deegan Smythe, a good friend from Australia, has a wonderful new vegan anthem that he's created. There's a nice article about unity and vegetarianism. See, unity actually is now someone within the Unity headquarters has written about how vegetarianism has always been part of unity. So they're starting to wake up, too. That's nice to see. Dan and Yogurt has just invested millions of dollars in vegan advertising for their new vegan ice cream. So lots of things are happening. You can see, and I'm a lot on here. So thank you all. Again, you can, you know, I won't go through all the degree of time, but, yeah, and this whole thing with Matt Balls, he was one of the founders of, ironically enough, of Vegan Outreach, but he's written this out, it was a YouTube video where he said that it's much better to eat one cow than, you know, if you're going to eat meat, eat cows. And our vegan advocacy hasn't worked, you know, or we should just tell people to eat cows. And I mean, very, very toxic from my point of view, very toxic kind of ideas. Karen Davis gave a great response to him. Yeah, I highly recommend you reading her article. There's a lot of powerful stuff. I mean, there's so many. There's new films coming out, Chasing Coral. This new one from Korea. I haven't seen it yet, but everybody's talking about it. It's got a funny name. But anyway, it's about a pig. There's lots. We actually just saw The Last Pig, too. It's very good. About the pig farmer who went vegan. And so there's, I'm telling you, there's just so much happening. So get out there, everybody, and carry on the movement. We really appreciate your support. If you have a chance, I never mentioned this, but the World Peace Diet is technically for people there's a like various sort of levels of making a monthly donation, scholarships. It can be very inexpensive. Not many people actually make any donation. I love doing it. But if you would like to help us out with World Peace Diet Circle, if you can go on our website, go to World Peace Mastery, worldpeacemastery.com, and click under Circle, and you can, I think there's four different levels of donating there. It's always nice to get a little help out on this. We love doing it. But I just want to thank all of you for the efforts that you're making, and know that we are part of a movement that is laying the foundation for a world where peace and freedom and justice, sustainability and equality are possible. And as Lily so beautifully said, it gives us a reason to wake up every morning with a feeling of joy in our hearts, because another day is another opportunity to share this message and to open to greater wisdom and understanding in our own lives, and to not only transform ourselves, but to perhaps plant seeds that will help other people to make positive changes, so that we can effectively begin to bring more alignment on this planet with our values. And instead of destroying everything, we can begin to find our purpose here on this earth and live in harmony with each other and with all of life on this beautiful, abundant planet. So much love to you all. Thanks so much for your participation. And the next gathering will be on the third Thursday of August, which is the 17th. We'll be doing it again in September on the 24th. First, but then I'm going to say right now, once we get into October, November, we're going to be in India, China. I don't know what's going to happen then, but we'll manage somehow. All right, much love to you all. Again, thanks so much for joining us, and I will close here with a little music, the Calf Song. Thanks again, and much love.